You're listening to a special edition of Midori House, first broadcast in Davos on the 24th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to a special edition of Midori House on Monocle 24, live from the World Economic Forum in Davos with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, one of the world's most influential financial columnists, Felix Salmon, will give us his take on the forum so far, from the speeches and panels to the dinners and parties. Then Marcus Carlson, business editor of France 24, will be on hand to guide us through the big events of the day, including the set-piece speeches from David Cameron and Angela Merkel. We'll be talking corruption with Cobus de Swart, managing director of Transparency International.
Very importantly for the issues that we hold dear, public accountability, integrity, we have seen some moves to deal with these fundamentals of social justice in the world economy, but not enough.
And we'll also find out what life in Davos is like for its residents when the circus rolls into town.
Years ago, the wives from the managers or so, they came with them and they go walking on the street every day and come in the shop and buy many things.
One of our neighbours here at Holland House, Ed Conway of Sky News, will, among other things, tell us what the delegates have made of the speeches so far.
This is the interesting thing you actually hear from business leaders. They're like, we're very in favour of democracy, just provided they make the right choice. And there is one choice that they need to make, which is staying in the EU.
All that plus another Swiss song. Yes, we've found one more that we like. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House, live from the World Economic Forum in Davos. But first, let's cross back to London, where Bill Bingham has the latest world headlines.
Monocle 24 News. One of the Islamist groups fighting in northern Mali says it wants dialogue. A statement from the breakaway Islamic movement for Azawad says it was splitting from Ansar Dine and that it rejects all forms of extremism and terrorism. France sent troops to Mali earlier this month because it believed Al-Qaeda-linked Islamists were threatening to turn Mali into a terrorist state. Meanwhile, a United States C-17 military cargo plane has landed in Mali carrying a French motorized infantry unit for the French forces. Colonel Sean Underwood, who's in charge of the American mission, says their contribution is a limited one.
The United States is engaged in logistical and intelligence support of the French military. We are not doing any combat operations. We have flown a total of, so far, 7 missions downrange, moving down to Mali. 7 missions, 200 passengers, French Army passengers, and 168 tons of cargo. This mission will continue again for 2 weeks.
The United Nations says there's been a big increase in the numbers of Syrian refugees arriving in Jordan, putting a heavy strain on resources. Jordan has already warned if there's a mass influx of refugees, it will close the border with Syria. The UN Refugee Council, UNHCR, said on Wednesday more than 26,000 refugees had crossed into Jordan since the 1st of January, more than 10,000 in the past 5 days. A Japanese Coast Guard vessel has fired its water cannon on a boat carrying Taiwanese activists who'd set sail for disputed islands in the South China Sea. The activists had planned to land on the islands but were forced to turn back. Taiwanese Coast Guards stepped in to defend them. The disputed islands, known as Senkaku in Japanese and Diaoyu in Chinese, are in an area where the seabed is believed to have valuable mineral reserves. President Barack Obama's nominee for Secretary of State, John Kerry, has begun the confirmation process with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Mr. Obama nominated the Massachusetts senator for the country's top diplomatic job last month, after Susan Rice, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, withdrew following criticism of her handling of a September attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. Senator Kerry is expected to sail through the confirmation process and could start his new job early next month. He told the committee of his admiration for the work of the current Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton.
Her service has been superb, and we all thank her for a job well done, for her tireless efforts on behalf of our nation. She has set a very high mark for the stewardship of the State Department and her commitment to country. And I can pledge to you that with the consent of the Senate, I will do everything in my power, summon every energy and all of my focus to build on her record and on the president's vision.
Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron has promised to promised action to limit tax avoidance strategies after a public backlash in the United Kingdom. His comments increase pressure on multinational corporations that seek to lower their tax bills aggressively. Tax avoidance by big companies has been heavily criticised as millions of Britons struggle against meagre wage growth and austerity measures to reduce the country's budget deficit. Firms that are viewed as paying too little tax have been targeted by demonstrators and boycotts. Mr. Cameron told CEOs and investors at the World Economic Forum in Davos, everyone must pay their fair share.
I know that some people might be thinking, he's talking about cracking down on tax avoidance, talking about making companies more transparent. Doesn't this sound like an anti-business, bash the rich, tax success agenda? Absolutely not. This is a resolutely pro-business agenda. I'm about the most pro-business leader you can find.
US Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has officially lifted the military's ban on women serving in combat roles. The ruling, which overturns a 1994 ruling, could open up hundreds of thousands of frontline positions to women. However, the military has until 2016 to argue for any specific posts they think should remain closed to women. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. Welcome back to Davos and Holland House. Now, our first guest tonight is a Davos regular. Not that that necessarily makes him a Davos fan. Felix Salmon, a financial blogger for Reuters, has in the past dubbed Davos a sybaritic alpine gabfest. There must be something rather amiable about Salmon, though, because for some reason he keeps on getting invited back. But then this was the man which New York Magazine dubbed the critic Wall Street loves to lunch with. Also joining us around the table is Gideon Rackman, foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times, author of Zero Sum World, and I've just discovered also something of a Davos veteran. Felix and Gideon, welcome to both of you. Felix, if we can start with you. Why are you here and what's the point of Davos for you?
I'm here honestly because I have to be. it's my job.
That's a good reason.
I have a very, very tolerant employer who allows me to do just about anything for 51 weeks of the year. And then the other week, if you get invited to Davos, this is the weird thing about Davos. If you get invited, it's more or less compulsory to come. And I kind of moan and groan a bit when I get the invite, but I secretly love it because you are surrounded by fascinating people. You always have a couple of amazing conversations. You'll meet a couple of new people. Today I met an intelligent House Republican. I didn't know such a thing existed.
Wow.
And you surprise yourself. And I have my mind changed on some obscure subject or other every single year I come. And I always learn something. And I love, frankly, also just to laugh at it. It's so easy and so much fun to laugh at everything that's going on. Like, how can you resist?
And Gideon, as a foreign affairs columnist, I mean, there are certain advantages to coming here, aren't there? Because of, I mean, just, you know, the number of other people that are already here that are worth talking to.
Sure. I mean, it's in a kind of, it doesn't sound efficient to come all the way up a Swiss mountain to talk to a bunch of other international affairs specialists, but in a way it is, because there are a lot of people here for 4 days. So just to give you an idea of what I've done today, some of them were kind of formal meetings, but the forum lays on that, so they kind of wheel in the Prime Minister of Russia, then the Prime Minister of Italy, then the Prime Minister of Egypt. So, and then, you know, we're going to dinner with a couple of Middle Eastern Prime Ministers. So you get a very kind of intense fix of world leaders. But also, as Felix was saying, there's a lot of kind of corridor conversation. So I've been very intrigued by this mission that the Americans sent to China and Japan just before the presidential election to basically try to calm down a potential war between those two countries. And then in the corridor, I bumped into one of the guys who was actually on it. And he was prepared to, you know, sit down and have a coffee with me and explain exactly what they'd said, what the reaction was. And that's invaluable. You know, I might have been able to get him on the phone from Washington, but somehow he would have been cagier if he weren't just kind of sitting around chatting. And
it would have quite been the same as well.
No, so it's a mix of the kind of organized stuff and then the sort of serendipity of just bumping into people. And then, as Felix said, there's a sort of fun aspect to it. You know, there are conversations going on about all sorts of weird things which I wouldn't normally either follow or have the opportunity to follow, and then suddenly, you know, you can go to a dinner on happiness, which sounds a bit ridiculous, but actually I went last night thinking it would be a sort of slightly absurd spectacle, but in fact it was a really interesting conversation between economists, psychologists, a Buddhist monk, and it was oddly really stimulating.
And Felix, we haven't just had a Buddhist monk, we've had a global rabbi as well that you've been meeting.
I've met a global rabbi. My very first Davos moment, literally the first day I arrived in Davos, on my very first Davos, I got into Davos Platz on the train and got the shuttle, and there was one other person in the shuttle who was an Ayatollah. And we got stuck in traffic and I had a 15-20 minute conversation with an Ayatollah. That is the kind of thing which just would never happen anywhere else.
Yeah, now I'll give you an example, a similar example, like 2 years ago when it was exactly the time of the Egyptian revolution going on, and we were saying, God, I wonder what the UN's doing. We were coming back from Egypt, and then Kofi Annan actually gets into the shuttle, and he said, well, what are you doing, actually? And he sort of, you know, have a bit of a chat about what he thinks, but he wasn't at that point still Secretary General, but he had a fair idea of how it would be working and what people would be saying to Mubarak and so on, and that was invaluable.
I mentioned
McLuhan turning up in Annie Hall.
Exactly like that. I mentioned earlier Sybaritic Alpine Gabfest. That was a quote from you, Felix, from, in fact, that Davos, because you were sort of saying, look, this is, you know, there was a huge event here happening in Egypt, and you had all the world's leaders and, you know, the self-proclaimed most important people in the world right here, yourselves included, not that you're self-proclaiming that. And yet there was something of a disconnect, wasn't there, between what was happening up a mountain and what was happening in Tahrir Square?
Massive disconnect. And to the point at which what you found, these huge crowds of people gathering around television screens, because the only interesting thing was on the television. And it was actually weird. You suddenly realized just how powerless and irrelevant all of the people up this mountain really were. When something real starts to happen in the world, then that puts everything into perspective.
Yeah. And when you, one other thing, just on final thing on the mocking of Davos, the language that's used.
It's hilarious.
You can give us some examples of, I've been asking everyone this week if they can give me an explanation for what resilient dynamism means. and no one even actually bothers to try and explain it. But I mean, there's something, isn't there, Gideon, about the language that's used here, which is easy to mock.
Yeah, I mean, it's deeply off-putting. I don't know who comes up with these absurd slogans, because they're both meaningless and bland and off-putting. But if you can sort of fight your way through them, actually, in the midst of all this, there are quite interesting people there. The forum comes up with its jargon. It must be part of some weird strategy.
It's there for a reason, because you don't get this many important people in the same place without being profoundly inoffensive and meaningless. Yeah. So if you say what you mean, someone is going to get offended. So you have to say something without meaning. So today my tweet du jour was I literally took a photograph of a television screen in the conference center where there were two upcoming sessions. The first one was called Shaping Digital Norms, which was 2 hours long from 9 to 11 a.m. And then there was Fostering Entrepreneurial Innovation, which was 1 hour long from 9 to 10 a.m. So I decided that clearly that means that Shaping Digital Norms takes twice as long as Fostering Entrepreneurial Innovation. But that's the only actual information that you can get from those titles. They mean nothing, but they deliberately mean nothing.
Now, aside from Shaping Digital Norms, when you sort of look over what you've done so far and what you still have to come over the next couple of days, are there sort of big, interesting things that have been talked about or you think are going to come up, which may or may not sort of shape your thinking over the coming weeks and months?
I hope so. It's difficult to say. You know, the way I think of this is that you have all these conversations and then they don't seem immediately useful sometimes, quite often actually. But the fact that you've had the opportunity, kind of, for somebody like me who has to write about international politics all the time, it's like sort of filling up a bottle. You know, there's stuff there, and then maybe in 6 months' time, a conversation I had here, I'll suddenly think, oh yeah, you know, that actually fits with that. And it's just I actually rather dread the idea that I'm going to have to write a column out of this, because there isn't a single big takeaway, to use that terrible word. I'll try to find one. But
well, one of the things I'm quite glad about is that people have stopped asking each other what's the mood in Davos. There was a period
that was
about 5 years
at our news conference
where people are like, what's the mood? So now we've thankfully moved on from what's the mood, and I think we've moved on, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the financial crisis, it was pretty obvious what everyone was talking about. And now we've moved on from this idea that everybody has to be talking about the same thing or caring about the same thing, or that there's some great sort of global synthesis that you can make of everything. As Gideon says, it's actually much more, you know, a few bits and pieces here and there. You know, I will always, you know a few things just because I came here, but not about big, global, important world leader type things. Normally it's much more particular. It's like a little thing about locavorianism or about the importance of exposure to daylight or something like that, which sticks with you.
Quickly, on that point, tell us about the exposure to daylight, because you were telling us this before we went on air, and I think it needs to be shared.
Humanity is doomed because we live all day inside rooms, and even a well-lit room doesn't have more than about 200 lux. In order to have a healthy circadian cycle, you need a good 8 hours sleep. We know that, and people know that they need to get more sleep. What they don't know is that they also need during the day to get exposure to light, and none of us do it, because on a cloudy day, there's about 10,000 lux outside. On a bright day, there's 150,000 lux. And in the conference center, in a room, in an office, we have maybe 100 or 200. So we're living in a circadian twilight.
And it's called this at Davos.
It completely messes up your circadian rhythms, and it makes you permanently jet lagged.
Brilliant. I think that's the perfect point to end on. a real lesson from Davos. Felix Salmon and Gideon Rachman, thank you both very much indeed. Coming up, part two of our chat with the head of Transparency International. Stay tuned. '17 here in Davos, 1817 in London. You're listening to Midori House. Corruption is not a subject that the CEOs and global leaders here at the World Economic Forum have always been happy to discuss. But, says our next guest, that has begun to change. Cobus de Swart is the Managing Director of Transparency International, and in recent years, particularly since the global financial crisis began 5 years ago, he believes that corruption issues are being taken a little bit more seriously. He came over to our studio earlier today, just after British Prime Minister David Cameron had called on an end to tax avoidance and evasion, another subject which de Swart believes is becoming increasingly prominent. We began by discussing the fate of the Eurozone, which many delegates believe is in a slightly better position than it was 12 months ago. Was it a feeling, I asked, that he shared?
Yes, I do get that feeling. I might not totally agree with it.
No?
But I think that surely an immense potential failure of economic stability has been averted. That's true, and I think there's a relief for that. At the same time, a lot of the fundamental problems remain in place. If we turn a little bit to the American economy and the debt ratios there, I think we are not out of the woods by a long mile. And I think that very importantly for the issues that we hold dear, public accountability, integrity, we have seen some moves to deal with these fundamentals of social justice in a world economy, but not enough.
When we look at some of those issues of public accountability, a number of people will say, well, let's look at Greece, for example. It's all very well that there's bailouts and so on, but we know there's a list of more than 2,000 very rich people in Greece who haven't been paying their tax. And we know exactly who those people are, and yet they still haven't paid their tax. Does that concern you?
Of course, it concerns me. Whenever you look around the world at issues of tax evasion, you are essentially talking about people that are stealing from their own public purse. I mean, I think that's a crime. At the same time, one needs to be even-handed here. It is true that many countries, such as Greece, have a major problem of tax evasion of their own citizens. But there's another side to that. We publish detail on the biggest multinationals in the world, and I dare you to guess how many of those, of the 40 of the 105 biggest ones operating in Greece, declared how much tax they paid in Greece 2 years ago, in 2011, the year we have data for.
No idea.
None. Not a single one. And I think this issue of tax and of equity is also about how governments operate, how their citizens behave, and how they enable their citizens, sometimes through tough regulation and enforcement of those, but it's also about how companies behave. And I think that's very important. One can't always just blame the others. One needs to, charity starts at home, and I think that a lot can be done in the Eurozone economy, not only to focus on the countries that have their problems, but on the general ways that we operate in Europe in terms of openness and transparency, and putting the data that is essential for citizens to know out in the public domain.
Do you think these issues are being talked about a bit more now, certainly following the beginning of the financial crisis?
Yes, I do think that there's a dramatic more attention to it. And it's gone through waves. When the financial crisis started to break, it's interesting that immediately all the major newspapers and politicians around the world said, we have a fundamental breakdown of integrity and accountability in the financial system. And that I think was a major step forward. Unfortunately, they haven't always maintained the cleaning up of this lack of public accountability. As you know, a lot of the first wave of response to the crisis was bailouts. Mm. And those bailouts most definitely had one dimension that was one that's not unproblematic insofar that you had the socialization of risk, in that it was ordinary citizens that bailed out companies through tax money, and the privatization of gain, which I think is a strange way of dealing with any crisis. But maybe that was the only way to deal with it at that point. But that most definitely gave citizens around the world even more so the right to know what happens with their money. And budget transparency and transparency of how the finances of countries are spent still lack a dramatic public accountability, in the same way that companies can do dramatically more to report on a country-by-country and project-by-project basis on their earnings. We see that happening in a very, very few countries and companies from a very few countries.
Are there good examples of either countries or companies where you feel, yes, these are the people that are doing it in the right way, that we can sort of show as, you know, the best example to the rest of the world?
There's a perhaps not an irony, but the companies and the countries are usually in sync with each other. So you by and large see more the companies from, say, for example, the Nordic countries being the better performance. And I think that's not, for insiders, it comes as no surprise, because it means they've got smart regulation and the companies also behave accordingly. So countries such as Norway is a good example. And not only because it does well, but it does well despite the fact that it's a resource-rich country. If you look across the board, natural resource-rich countries perform, by and large, very poor. If you look back, say, the last 40 years, the absolute majority of 80% of the world's richest countries in terms of natural resources have had a decline in their economic growth, mostly because of poor governance. Norway there went the other way, very public, and that's why you see companies such as Statoil in an industry which is not known for its openness and transparency doing quite well.
Now you're talking about issues of corruption and transparency and accountability. We're here at the World Economic Forum. Do these guys like you here?
Well, it's most definitely a strange experience in some ways.
Yes, is it?
No, because clearly the way that we operate as Transparency International is with a critical but constructive engagement with all stakeholders. There's no point for us to try and just name and shame to make us famous for a day, but ultimately we want to actually move the needle. And to do that, you'd need to engage with people. That means also that we don't go out to shame people. At the same time, we will speak truth to power, particularly in an environment like this. over the years that I've been coming here, I think there's a greater sense from particularly CEOs and also from governments that they need us. They need to tackle this issue. And for business, it's very simple. Business leaders understand that corruption is a very unsustainable business strategy. They need to find ways to get out of the dilemmas they sometimes find themselves in.
We heard Mario Monti yesterday talking about corruption. You know, a few years ago, the idea of an Italian prime minister going anywhere and admitting that his country had a problem with corruption would have been surprising, to say the least. I mean, obviously, you know, Mario Monti is almost certainly on his way out. He's unlikely to be prime minister after the next election. He can maybe say these sorts of things. But despite that, I mean, were you still pleasantly surprised? You see that as a good sign?
Yeah, I think not only did he say that, he highlighted it's one of the biggest challenges facing Italy. He did actually say that even when he was not planning to leave. So let's give credit to him there. At the same time, admitting that you have a problem is just the first step. And I think that he was very clear that the reforms that Italians have started, and particularly reforms that will enable a dramatically increased public accountability on public spending, is only in its infancy and it's not irreversible yet.
Kobus de Swart, we'll leave it there. Kobus de Swart from Transparency International, thank you very much for joining us here on Monocle 24. 1926 here in Davos. The name the World Economic Forum and the name Davos appear to be pretty interchangeable for most people here, but for a good 5,000 or so, they are very different things. Their Davos is not the same as our Davos. It is, after all, a town. Their town. There is the Davos of the Congress Centre, the Davos of different coloured badges and security guards, and then there is the Davos of florists and tea shops, karate clubs and yoga centres. We sent Manon Spindler out to find the real Davos and hear what they make of their namesake.
My name is Jens Scheer. I'm the owner of the restaurant Genziana in Davos. And I'm managing the business now during the WEF.
And how does the business change during the WEF?
So during the WEF it's more busy, we sell other things, but we have all over the year the same menu, so always all over the year the same prices, so we have only more business during this week.
And what are the top-selling dishes during the WEF?
Yeah, so we are most known for our traditional food, so our specialties are fondues, cheese, meat fondue, snails, and we are well known for our cozy ambience.
And what kind of people are coming to your restaurant?
So it's from the investment bankers to the politicians. So they don't say who is coming before, but we see there are much VIPs. For us, the guests are always the same if there are whips or if they are normal people.
My name is Sybil Cash. I'm from Davos. I'm living here and I'm working here in a cheese shop. It's a family shop, my parents and me.
And how does your factory change, your cheese factory? How does the business change during the WEF?
So we speak much more English, so there are more international people here and we need cheese and more of the fondue and raclette and just the local products.
And what are your top three best sellers?
I think we need a lot of wine and, of course, the fondue and maybe dessert. Maybe also the fondue pots and like this. They really like the special Swiss traditional products. So I think pots and this, yeah.
My name is Franny Federici and I have the tea shop in Davos since 18 years.
And can you tell me how your business changed during the WEF?
It's very quiet and it's nothing in the shop. We have many orders per phone and so. But during the WEF, it's not good for us.
Why do you think the business slowed down?
I think years ago, the wives from the managers or so, they came with them. And they go walking on the street every day and come in the shop and buy many things. And now, since 3 or 4 years, the business people come alone and chauffeurs picked up from the Congress House. and bring it to the hotels, and the people go not on the street, walk not on the street. And
why do you think was this change?
I think the security is more now. Years ago, the people make a demonstration in Davos, and every people from Davos has angry from this, and now the woman comes not with the businessmen.
And that was Manon Spindler out in the real Davos, finding out where the Davos wives have gone.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll chat with Frans van Katte's business editor, Marcus Carlson, talk to Ed Conway of Sky News, and we'll also be joined by Michelle Wooker, president of the World Policy Institute and publisher of World Policy Journal.
An amazing, amazing group of people who are not what you normally hear about when you hear about Davos. They're people who are nominated under 40 years of age and are all out to change the world for the better, whether through social entrepreneurship or as NGOs, as media, or through business.
But first, back to London, where Bill Bingham has the news headlines.
One of the Islamist groups fighting in northern Mali says it wants dialogue. A statement from the breakaway Islamic movement for Azawad says it was splitting from Ansar Dine and that it rejected all forms of extremism and terrorism. France sent troops to Mali earlier this month because it believed Al-Qaeda-linked Islamists were threatening to turn the country into a terrorist state. The United Nations says a big increase in the numbers of Syrian refugees arriving in Jordan is putting a heavy strain on resources. Jordan's already warned if there's a mass influx of refugees, it'll close the border with Syria. The UN Refugee Council said more than 26,000 Syrian refugees had crossed into Jordan since the 1st of January. A Japanese Coast Guard vessel has fired its water cannon on a boat carrying Taiwanese activists who'd set sail for disputed islands in the South China Sea. The activists had planned to land on the islands but were forced to turn back. Taiwanese Coast Guards then stepped in to defend them. President Barack Obama's nominee for Secretary of State, John Kerry, has begun the confirmation process with the State Foreign Relations Committee. Mr. Obama nominated the Massachusetts senator for the country's top diplomatic job last month after Susan Rice, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, withdrew following criticism of her handling of a September attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi in Libya. Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron has promised action to limit tax avoidance strategies after a public backlash in the United Kingdom. His comments increase pressure on multinational corporations that seek to lower their tax bills aggressively. US Defence Secretary Leon Panetta has officially lifted the military's ban on women serving in combat roles. The ruling, which overturns a 1994 rule, could open up hundreds of thousands of frontline positions to women. However, the military has until 2016 to argue for any specific posts they think should remain closed to women. And those are the latest Monocle 24 headlines.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. Welcome back to Holland House here at the World Economic Forum in Davos. And we've been joined here in Holland House by one of its other residents, Marcus Carlson, who's a business editor for Frans van Katte, who's been broadcasting just a couple of floors above us. He's also just arrived fresh from the conference centre where he's been moderating a panel on youth unemployment. Marcus, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with that panel that you've just been moderating over in the Congress Centre. It couldn't have been better timed. In the earlier today, we discovered that Spain's youth unemployment has now risen to 60%. And what were the sort of issues that were coming out on the panel? Was there anything in terms of a suggestion of a solution?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there was a lot of talk about how growth in the Eurozone is essentially the main problem. As long as you don't have growth in the Eurozone, you're not likely to be able to grapple better with the problem of youth unemployment. Around about a quarter of 15 to 24 year olds in the Eurozone are currently out of a job or out outside education. So this issue is a major issue, of course. And I'm actually surprised to hear so many people talk about that problem here in Davos. That includes chief executives, that includes senior economists, Nobel Prize winning economists. And another thing that I think came out of the session is the need to really try to foster entrepreneurship in Europe. There was an acknowledgement, perhaps, that European societies are not really great or good at fostering entrepreneurship. It's not something that we talk about in school. For instance, I grew up in Sweden and I never learned how to start my own company. That was nothing that you even thought about back then. And that perhaps is something that governments can do something about. Well, they can do that.
You talk about growth and the need for growth. Do you think that the conversation started to change over the last sort of 12 months or so, that, you know, a lot of politicians, and some still do, certainly those in Britain in government, talk about the need to get rid of the deficit, to pay down some of the debts, and so that's the priority. And growth is, well, we'll get on to growth, and obviously we favour it, but, you know, we must sort out our deficits first. Do you get the feeling that actually the debate has moved on elsewhere in Europe, and that growth is seen as now more important than any issues over austerity?
I do believe so. I mean, as late as today, Angela Merkel said that austerity, or she implied that austerity is working, because she was saying that, look, we're not seeing the payoffs just yet, but they will come further down the line.
That's not saying it's working, that's saying, trust me, it will work.
Pretty much, you know, hold on. That was the message from the German Chancellor Angela Merkel today, or at least that was my take on her speech here in Davos, one of the most well-watched speeches. I think the conversation has completely changed from last year, because last year in Davos, we were talking about firewalls. If I would have had €1 for every time someone said the word firewalls last year, I would be a very, very wealthy man at this point. Perhaps not a billionaire, but at least a millionaire. We're no longer talking about the Eurozone falling apart. Everyone is acknowledging the fact that the Eurozone looks as if it's here to stay, at least for now. No one's going to leave in the near term. And I think the conversation has turned more onto longer term issues like growth, indeed. Also, climate change, something else that we didn't really hear about that last year. Now we are hearing more and more about it.
How important do you think it is, the debate here in Davos, in terms of shaping what the global agenda really is? I mean, you know, if we were talking to, you know, the head of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, he'd say, oh yes, absolutely, you know what says at Davos, you know, leads the world. But I mean, do you think there's an element of truth in that?
It's difficult to say, because the thing about Davos is that there are no firm decisions coming out of it. There is no final communique where the World Economic Forum puts everything together and comes out with a message. So it's difficult to say what kind of impact it actually has. A lot of chief executives, for instance, that I've been speaking to, they say that this is a great place to get a sense of where the global economy is going. It's a great place to make contacts and perhaps build up relationships further down the line. So it's very difficult to say what the actual impact is of Davos. Of course, I mean, this town has an incredibly important footprint in the global economy, seeing that so many people are here at the same time. But it's difficult to say exactly where it's heading from here.
I want to ask you just briefly at the end about Frans van Katt's coverage, because you're there's what, 12, 13 of you here. You're covering it in three languages, French, English and Arabic. Mm-hmm. Do you look at what the competition is doing? Who is your competition here, really? How do you sort of put together your schedule for the day?
Well, we have different competition and different rivals for each language, because of course in Arabic we're talking Al Jazeera, we're talking Al Arabiya. In English we're talking about BBC World News, we're talking about CNN. So those are my rivals. Do I look at the others and what the others are doing? Sure. You know, you carefully ask each other as you pass each other in the corridors, who do you have today? Do you have anyone interesting? What are you doing? You always try to suss it out, what the others are doing. So yeah, sure, there is
David Cameron first. Why didn't we?
Well, you know, yes, it's going to be difficult for François Guettre to get David Cameron. Sure. I suppose that's more of a BBC story, but certainly you talk a lot about yeah, who did you get? That's the common question.
And is it an important part of Frans van Kat's sort of year now to sort of to come to Davos? Is it important for you to have a presence to hang your banner out the front of Holland House and make sure that you get as many CEOs and bankers and politicians coming into your studio?
I think there are two sides to that coin. Of course, you have amazing access here in Davos. You get the opportunity, or I get the opportunity, to interview people in just in 1 week that it would probably take me 6-7 weeks to actually try to assemble those interviews and even have a chance of getting those interviews. And yes, as you're implying, it's also important here to be seen. Of course, for a media organization like France 24, we are 6-7 years old. And perhaps a lot of opinion makers and leaders are not completely aware of the fact that we exist. Now they are. Our profile is growing, partly because of Davos.
Marcus Carlson, business editor of Frans van Kat, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here in Davos. We'll be right back after this with some music, and then we'll be heading out onto the balcony. Well, we'll be... that's cheating, to be honest. We head out onto the balcony a little bit earlier. It is so cold out there. There's no way I'm going out there right now. But we chatted with another one of our neighbours, Ed Conway, Sky News' economics editor.
Sichuan was one of China's poorest provinces until investment from Beijing and abroad brought boom time to its capital. Monocle's video journalist Gabriel Li paid a visit to Chengdu to gauge the progress.
Here the changes are radical. This has become a much more international city, and every day you see it growing more and more. This is the new market inside of China, which is, it's not a market itself, it's a continent. Foreign companies that want to sell something in China, now they're trying to come here. And you can see they're coming here.
Chengdu, the new China, in the films menu on Monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House, coming to you live from Davos. We promised you Swiss music, and my word, we've dug out something. This is Vicar with Who You Are, featuring, I kid you not, Heidi Happy.
Getting ready for the night, where the nicest. Then I hear you from the back singing, and I wonder who you are.
That was Wicca with Who You Are featuring Heidi Happy. Now we normally wait until Friday before we meet the neighbours on Midori House, but since this is our last show at the World Economic Forum, we thought we'd do a special version here in Davos. Our home from home has been Holland House, a one-time hospital turned hotel, which this week has played host to media from around the world. One floor up from us are BBC World. Just down the corridor, we've got CCTV. A little further along, New Delhi TV appears to have monopolised the rest of the third floor. And as you heard a little earlier, France van Kat are up on the sixth floor. Sky News have been broadcasting from the fifth floor. And earlier today, I invited their economics editor, Ed Conway, to compare the view from our balcony, as well as to discuss a few of the bigger issues of the forum. Ed Conway, thank you very much for joining us on our balcony. Not far from your balcony.
We're two floors up, which I don't know if that's promotion here. Do the listeners, are they aware of the lavish luxury in which we're sitting here? One of the smartest kind of hotels stroke hostels stroke hospitals I've ever been to in my life.
It did used to be a hospital, yes. It certainly looks very good. Certainly the view, which is, of course, of more benefit for viewers than for listeners. But we've got the Alps sort of in the background. How does Sky cover an event like Davos?
Well, it's a big event, and you've got to be here, really. I mean, we're all of us, you know, even the people who come here and who supposedly love it. Everyone's a little skeptical about what is Davos for, and we're always asking that question within Sky, and we're asking that to a lot of people out here. And in the end, it comes down to it's people, really. It's the fact that you have such a concentration of people that everyone wants to hear from in such a small square mile or even less. And you can just go straight up to them and put a camera in front of their face, in our case, when you're allowed in to certain places, yes. Which is not a given. It's a combination for us of seeing what people are talking about here. And there is a lot of news bouncing around. There is a kind of assumption that no news actually inflicts itself on the world from Davos. Davos doesn't create news. But it certainly is a kind of good sounding board. So when big things are happening, you know, as with this talk about the UK and the EU referendum, then this is the place where you're going to hear the world's most biggest authorities on that issue.
And we certainly seem to have had more news being created by Davos than normally. You mentioned David Cameron's speech yesterday, obviously in London, about Britain's position within the EU, which has been talked about an awful lot here. But also you made another speech here this morning on tax and transparency, which again seems to have created some headlines. Yeah. What did you make of that speech? It seemed a lot stronger on these issues of dealing with tax avoidance and tax evasion than he's spoken about before.
They don't like it here. I mean, you know, inherently, there's no reason why you would like it if you're a multinational businessman who has a company that works across the entire world. You may use transfer pricing. This is the technique that some multinationals use in order to try to reduce tax bills in some parts of the world. So you're kind of involved in this debate. And the notion that you're having someone coming on stage and saying, well, not only we're going to clamp down on this, not only making a certain reference to a coffee company in his speech, you're going to wake up and smell the coffee.
Yes, I'm sure Starbucks love
exactly.
that.
Exactly. But also saying at the same time, there's a chance that we may have a referendum on EU membership. And this is a place, Davos is a place which is inherently internationalist. It's about, you know, this is where the bureaucrats come from around the world. It's where people who run companies come from around the world. And the agenda is very much international. It's about trying to create institutions internationally which can help make the world a better place. And the notion that you have someone coming along and saying, well, we may be retreating from that, and also we may be making life a little tougher for your companies if you want to try to let's say, make your tax more efficient, which is the way that the accountants like to put it, they don't like that much at all here.
Use the word may. I mean, it's one thing for a prime minister to come here and say, wake up and smell the coffee. I haven't seen him outline any changes in the law to actually crack down on those sorts of tax loopholes.
But it's so difficult. I mean, that is, some senses, you have to have sympathy for individual politicians, because this is something which is a product of the modern era. You know, you didn't really have international tax avoidance of this sort before, by 1970, partly because there used to be a totally different international monetary system in place, which let's not get into that, but partly also because this is the age of international capital floating around the world, going from one country to another, you know, without friction.
And you can claim that, yes, your intellectual property rights are based in one country which just happens to have no tax whatsoever, and therefore you can move your profits from higher tax places.
So you need to deal with it internationally if you are going to deal with it at all.
But then let's take those two things together. You know, Cameron yesterday saying, we're not sure we want to be that pro-European, and today saying, we need to all come together to deal with tax. Surely this is the sort of thing where actually countries need to work together.
It is, and that is in a sense what Davos is all about. But I think you're also seeing a breakdown in trust of the big international organizations, and you've seen that, you know, actually for more than the last decade. People don't trust the UN, the EU, the IMF, the ILO. There's all of these institutions, and including the World Economic Forum, to provide the best kind of attention that for them individually. They see these institutions as being slightly irrelevant. You know, a lot of people aren't quite sure what the OECD really does. And as a result, the kind of force and the power you have in these institutions which are supposed to sort out international issues is diminishing. And that's why David Cameron realizes politically that speech yesterday was almost a necessity for him politically, and has gone down amongst some people very well indeed. The last time he did something kind of anti-Europe or skeptical of Europe, back at the EU, the summit a couple of years ago, where he voted against the treaty being put in place, that was one of the best kind of moves in terms of the polls. It's the biggest poll-boosting move that he's had, you know, for his entire prime ministership. So he realises that there's not as much enthusiasm for these things anymore. And it's difficult for the people here to argue against that, except to say, oh, come on, you know, eventually the British people, this is the interesting thing you actually hear from business leaders. They're like, we're very in favour of democracy. We're big fans of democracy.
But
it's a great thing.
Can people do things that we want them to
do? Yeah, just provided they make the right choice, and there is one choice that they need to make, which is staying in the EU.
That was Ed Conway, economics editor for Sky News. It's 1950 here in Davos, 1850 in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, Monocle is, of course, not the only magazine out here in the sub-zero Swiss tundra. Publications from every corner of the globe have canvassed this tiny town in the Alps in search of stories to file home. A bit earlier, we caught up with Michelle Wooker, publisher of World Policy Journal and also president of the World Policy Institute, and of course, a young global leader. Isn't everyone here a young global leader? I wanted to know what was on her schedule here in Davos.
I get a lot of things out of Davos. I get to plug into some of the conversations that are going on globally. Some older, more stodgy conversations, but also a lot of new conversations. A lot of great connections, particularly among the Young Global Leaders group. It's an amazing, amazing group of people who are not what you normally hear about when you hear about Davos. They're people who are nominated under 40 years of age and are all out to change the world for the better, whether through social entrepreneurship or as NGOs, as media, or through business. And they are fantastic, dynamic, creative, goal-oriented, impact-oriented people. And so just being part of that community is the real highlight of Davos for me.
And what have your impressions been so far? I mean, this is your first time here in Davos. What were you expecting beforehand, and has it met or exceeded those expectations?
Well, I've been to a lot of the regional summits, so the format is very similar to that. The sheer size of it is a bit overwhelming at best. The YGLs had a Facebook group where we shared stories from veterans and ideas of what to expect. So I had a pretty good idea of what was going to be here. It was, go to the Belvedere for the parties and the piano bar. And the best piece of advice was from Kate Roberts, a fellow YGL, who said, be sure to get 8 hours of sleep at least one night.
Right. Has that happened yet?
7.5.
Okay, that counts.
That counts.
Yeah,
although
yeah.
I actually bumped into a WEF veteran in New York, and I told him about that advice. He says, oh, if you're doing that, you're not doing Davos right. But we have a saying among the YGLs, protect the asset, which means that if you want to be at your best, you need to make sure to take care of yourself. And I think that's such an important thing. So I protected the asset, or at least half an hour short of it.
Indeed. When you look at the reputation of Davos, certainly before the financial crisis, it was seen as, meetings of the great and the good and the masters of the universe and a little bit of a celebrity sparkle dust as well. It's changed somewhat since then. It's become a little bit more sober. A number of people talk about humility, which isn't necessarily a word you always associate with Davos attendees. Do you think it's Davos has a bit of a reputation problem, or that the reality of this forum is perhaps different from the image?
I think there are probably lots of layers of realities of the forum. The layer that I'm in has been a very positive one, but I think that every year you do tend to see the same stories about the private jets and all the celebrity stuff. Certainly there's an element of that, but if that's all you're coming for, then in my view, you're not doing Davos right. I have heard some of the sincere change the world kind of thoughts. I was very impressed last night with Christine Lagarde's speech, talking about the need for inclusion, particularly gender equality, youth, of transparency. And on many occasions, I've heard people talking about the importance of addressing severe income inequality. Just the fact that people are talking so much about it is a very positive step, and I'm looking forward, hopefully, that my glasses aren't too rose-colored, to seeing something actually happen in the real world.
Because there is that aspect of Davos, isn't it? It's very easy to make a statement here and say something should be done, and then there's not always that follow-through. Do you think that part of what you and the other young global leaders are trying to do is ensure that you don't just come here and talk about potentially exciting new ideas and new ways of thinking, but actually turn that into practice?
Very much so. The YGLs put together a number of initiatives to create change in the real world. And as those are developed, people ask themselves, how can I measure this? How can I track this? what's the actual output I want and what's the outcome of that going to be? How is this really going to impact the real world? A lot of YGL women are working on closing the gender gap, which means something different to just about everybody, but the purpose is the same. So there have been a lot of conversations about what can we do in our circles of influence to close the gender gap.
For example, the gender gap here is quite stark. It's 17-18% of attendees are female.
It is, although among the YGLs, it's considerably better. And I think it's good that the WEF is reaching out to younger people, not just YGLs, but the whole new group of 20-somethings, the global shapers. And among those younger cohorts, you'll see a lot more women, which is fantastic. We are particularly working on an initiative to get women on boards, both corporate and nonprofit boards, but really looking at women's leadership in the business world and also women's thought leadership, which is a topic that's near and dear to my heart as a woman running an international think tank. There's a lot of data on the underrepresentation of women in the media, and the three biggest areas are international topics, economics, and security. And since the World Policy Institute works so much with up-and-coming thinkers, we particularly look for women who are writing on those issues and help them to have a platform and get their voices out there. So the thought leadership is so closely tied into other kinds of leadership.
It is part of the problem on that, in that too often it's men who are organizing these events and they don't really think about it. I mean, there's in the last couple of years, there's been a sort of a growing movement of men saying, I'm not going to appear on any all-male panel. Now, you've seen it in various different sectors all over the world. It hasn't quite caught fire. And looking through the list of events here at Davos, certainly Davos hasn't necessarily taken that on board. But I mean, are those the sort of concrete steps you think should be taken?
That's certainly a start. And we found that so many men are dedicated to that, particularly fathers. Several of the YGLs who are involved with the Closing the Gender Gap say, you know, I've got two young girls and I don't want them to come into the business world the way it is right now, is that I want to make sure that that's changed by the time they get there. And what's important is the Closing the Gender Gap is not just a women's issue. It's something that helps everyone. The global economy really depends on it. You've got 50% or slightly more of the population that's economically excluded. That's going to have huge implications for economic growth, for income, for human capital. So by neglecting half of the population, you're really creating a big drag on the global economy. And by investing in women and helping them up, men are going to reap far more than what they invest in that. So it's a fantastic return.
That was Michelle Wooker, publisher of World Policy Journal and the World Policy Institute. And that is all we have time for today. Indeed, that's the end of our series of Davos shows, this special series of Midori House programmes live from the World Economic Forum here in Davos. We're produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Manon Spindler and Alexandra de Kramer, and our studio manager was Sam Impey. Thank you to everyone here at Holland House for making us feel so welcome. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Urbanist. Midori House will be back in Midori House itself at the same time tomorrow, as hopefully will all of us. But for now, from me, Steve Bloomfield, and all of us here in Davos, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.